I didn't realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a backseat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills, so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is Duray, and welcome to Boston to People. This episode, it's me, Miles, and Kaya talking about the underreported news of the last week. There's a lot we talked about today. And don't forget to follow the podcast at Pod Save the People on Instagram. Let's go.
Family, 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 welcome to another episode of Pod Save the People. My name is Kaya Henderson, and you can find me sometimes on Twitter at HendersonKaya.
My name is Miles E. Johnson. You can find me at Instagram sometimes, most times, at Feral Rapture.
And this is Duray at DIY on Twitter.
So, it has been a very chock-full week. Lots of stuff happening and lots of sad stuff. We lost three Black men who were icons of the entertainment world. First, we lost James Earl Jones, who, I don't know if you know this, did you know that he was the first celebrity guest on Sesame Street ever? Period, the end.
I did not know that.
And that kicked off a career that, you know, I mean, he was the narrator of our lives. He was Darth Vader. He was lots of things, too many things to name. And then shortly thereafter, we lost Frankie Beverly, who is, you know, one of my friends said, Frankie Beverly is the cookout king. Frankie Beverly brought us White Parties and the soundtrack of Generations, that have been redone by, you know, today's folks. And he just was an icon. And then yesterday we lost Tito Jackson, who, you know, again, an icon, the Jackson 5, the consistent person in the group, the guitarist, the, like, I don't know. Something is going on in heaven and they need Black men entertainers, huh? It must be an exciting party.
Frankie's name ain't even Frankie.
Yo, did you not know that?
I did not know that. You knew that?
I knew that. So I might be in a relationship with the largest Frankie Beverly fan that ever existed.
Oh.
Uncle Mike knows every single word to every single Frankie Beverly
song. I was like, who is Howard? They put the wrong name in the article.
No, he named himself, he picked up the moniker Frankie because he was a huge fan of Frankie Lymons, who was a singer in the 50s maybe, and named himself after Frankie Lymons, which was an interesting fact. Also interesting fact, Marvin Gaye founded or discovered Frankie Beverly and Maze. And okay. His song, Silky Silky Soul Singer, is about Marvin Gaye and the special relationship that they have had. Okay. Not that kind of special, you know, special mentoring.
You never know. Leave people alone. So I think a few episodes ago, I said something about how I think Black people, specifically Black men, how we need a Bruce Springsteen and how Bruce Springsteen really occupies a specific space in a lot of Americans' hearts, but a lot of white Americans' hearts that just feels down home. And I don't think anybody comes close but James Earl Jones in Frankie Beverly. I think when I think about the legacy of happiness, of joy, happy feelings, We Are One, Golden Time of Day.
Southern Girl.
Oh my gosh. It's just the legacy of warmth that he has led. It's just astonishing. And then my little James Earl Jones thing is one of my favorite episodes, or excuse me, one of my favorite projects of James Earl Jones is this fairy tale anthology that he hosted. And it's interesting because Shelley Duvall did a very similar thing too, but basically it's a fairy tale anthology. I think it's called like Long Ago and Far Away. And it's an anthology of fairy tales. And anytime the intersection, specifically Sesame Street, when we were talking about that, anytime the intersection of Black men and education and children come up, it just warms my heart. So, yeah, we lost some real ones.
I will say, you know, one of the things that surfaced online about James L. Jones's death, if you didn't see it, was the resurfacing of some interviews that he had done where he was not particularly kind about Black women. I don't know if you saw these.
Don't say what now? What?
You did, Miles, you must have seen him.
About James Earl Jones?
Yeah. It wasn't a blip. It was not like a blip on the internet radar. It was like a thing.
Here's what's interesting about that to me. One, I'm sort of sad to hear that, that that's how he felt. And like, I guess I don't really care. And here's the reason why. I don't want nobody who don't want me. I happen to think that Black women are amazing and wonderful. And I think that if you don't want us, then I don't want you neither. And I can appreciate your acting and your whatever the case may be. I think it's unfortunate. But, you know, people are complicated. And who knows what he experienced to make him think that way. Maybe I'm just an old lady and I can't give these things that kind of energy anymore. Love is hard to find. Find it with who you want it. And leave. Just leave. If you don't like Black women, just don't say nothing. Go find your white lady and keep it moving. Sorry. That's how I genuinely feel. That is. Sorry.
Yeah. The internet's weird. And that's why I'm very happy to mainly be informed by stuff. Either it has to get to me in a certain, it just can't get to me on Twitter because of how arguments are just manipulated on Twitter. Because this is a 93-year-old man, and I say this today all the time, but people don't listen. But do you know what things you have to collude with and seduce in order to have had a career in the 70s. So even in this article, I believe that I saw them list Harry Belafonte and Sidney Poitier, and these are all Black men. And Eartha Kitt notoriously had a speech about how she was disrespected by her Black men peers as well. That is the climate of that. And in order to get into white supremacist Hollywood, to think you aren't somehow colluding with white supremacy, to me, I'm just like, yeah, of course. And just in the same way, if I read Hemingway, that is a misogynist. That is a racist. The words are good. So that, I feel the same way about when I hear things about James Earl Jones. I think the symbolism of him being a Black man and doing Sesame Street and him doing the fairy tales and him being Darth Vader and all these other things is great. But even during his lifetime, he got a lot of pushback critically about him being the sole Black person in Star Wars, being just a voice and being an evil voice at that. And in order to do well in Hollywood, even today, there has to be some type of assimilation and collusion with white supremacy. And I think just picking out evidence of that is, it's fine for argument and for fodder and for a good 48-hour argument. But at the end of the day, I think a more useful dissection would be, oh, how are we still doing that today in 2024? Who's still doing that today in 2024? Who's still platforming white supremacist ideals and manipulating and advancing minstrelsy in order to play the Hollywood game? And how can we critique that? But a 93-year-old dead man, it's that ticker for me is up.
Well, also this week, speaking about dead people, Somebody tried to assassinate
They
Mr.
did
Trump.
Not.
Oh, they didn't?
I don't believe it. No, I heard the news.
I don't know why that leeway.
I was like, wait a minute.
It didn't happen. God, yeah, this man was on a golf course. How did this other guy know he was there? You know, Elon has already deleted his account so nobody can see his old tweets. It didn't. This is at a point, you know, you got to try something new, Trump. Making up assassination attempts is not even making a news cycle, really.
Fascinating.
for everybody who can't see, because the thing about it is this is audio in film. So anybody who couldn't see, DeRay did a classic. I've seen 95-year-old grandpas and 5-year-old kids do that little "and what you gonna do about it" look that DeRay did, that blink. like I said it and did the, you just missing that little Vice President Harris hand underneath your chin when you do it.
Didn't happen.
I wasn't even ready for that. I was ready to report the news. There was a second assassination attempt. DeRay said happen. It didn't happen.
It didn't happen.
Interesting is, you know, this the martyrdom strategy, right? I was reading an article about, and I'm not going to remember his name, but there was a congressperson who previously was kind of a moderate Republican. It was in the Atlantic. And he has shifted completely and totally to being a MAGA Republican. His friends and his family members, I want to say Mike Lee, but I'm not sure about that. Check for me. But his friends and his family members say they don't recognize him because he's so far out for Trump. And when they were trying to explain why this happened, they basically said that he has experienced, when he started doing research on Trump, he experienced like the whole world being against Trump and him not getting a fair shake and all of this like Trump as the victim thing. And that made him completely shift his perspective and go hard in the paint for Mr. Trump. And so I think that there is something, I think that, you know, this martyrdom victimhood strategy works with a set of people. And I think that at this point, the Republican campaign or the Trump campaign is trying to pull out every single stop to re-engage their base. And there are a bunch of people for whom this martyrdom story is real. And I think that may be why there's not a new trick. Maybe it may be the same trick because it worked before.
As you were speaking, Kaya, I also was reading the ABC News report, kind of saying things that we know so far about who this man is. The reason why I'm not totally on the "it's fake" trail is it seems as though everybody who's attempting is on the right. It seems as though, and I haven't dug enough into as much digging as I have done. I guess like I haven't gotten dirty enough. I haven't dug enough into the right to know where the flip is happening, where there's obviously people who are on the right who are not satisfied, so unsatisfied with Trump that they're planning violent acts or in attempting violent acts. And to me, that's something there that doesn't necessarily make sense in the whole idea of, oh, he's recreating. I get it intellectually, like recreating martyrdom in order to get sympathy from voters, but something doesn't feel right about that when I think about who are the people who are usually behind it and what's happening. I think that these radicals, these people who Trump has helped radicalize are now radically against him because he's not in support of the... I feel like he's saying things that they don't like. I think the things about abortion that he's saying, how weird he was during debates. I think a lot of the things he's stepping back on is infuriating right-wing extremists. That's what it appears to be to me.
Yeah, Miles, I actually think what's happening, and this came out when the first questionable was there an assassination attempt happened, is that there's like a whole subculture in the right that is convinced that if he gets killed, it will actually cement the right strategy. So they are his supporters, but they are like, if Trump gets killed, then this will usher in a true radical movement and they'll be even more energized than what Trump was able to do. So I think that it's an extension of his, of what he's done. I don't think it's like a rebellion against it. And that's why, even with the first attempt, it's like, okay, the people, the MAGA people are like, we told the police, we told the Secret Service, we saw the man climb up on the roof. He had a gun. Nobody did anything. You're like, okay, this guy, you're like, well, how do you even get 500 feet? Like, how do you get that close to the president at the golf course? It's hard to get close to Kamala. It's, you know, Barack Obama, you up here, you know, you in the room and you 10,000 feet away. You know what I mean?
Right.
But anyway, we got other news to talk about, but let's get this election over with. This is killing us all.
Oh my gosh. I think that this is fantastic because it's only 6 weeks left, maybe 5 weeks left. And, you know, I think we should always have sort of 90-day elections or what have you, because at least it will be over pretty shortly.
I do love that we did not have to spend weeks in Iowa. Like, I love that we missed that part of the news where Kamala would be in somebody's kitchen in Iowa. And you're like, well, right, I don't know if Iowa is a bellwether for. Yeah, yes. I'm like, skip Iowa. Mm. I mean, shout out to Iowa. We love you people in Iowa. I'm like, no knock to you, but I don't know if that should be where the primary begins.
I hate Taylor Swift tweet. Talk about it.
What was he thinking? Clearly, I don't know. All of it just feels like a child online. I hope Taylor does a sit-down interview with Kamala Harris just to, like, cement it, because he will unravel. And the Swifties, whether you like them or not, they are an energized group of people. And when 400,000 people clicked the link to register to vote, when she put up that one Instagram story with no comment, like she didn't, it wasn't like she was voicing it over. If she just does a little bit, it'll go a long way, which is why he is doing this stuff. So I hope she leans all the way into this one.
I'm Taylor Swift, like, agnostic, but just full transparency, I just have never cared about Taylor Swift. I am scared though, because
what are you scared of?
I remember Kathy Griffin, right? And a lot of people don't remember Kathy Griffin, people don't remember everything that happened to Kathy Griffin. Yeah. And that is a horrifying thing. If you watch her documentary on it, her interviews, anything, she's obviously an amazing speaker. But
give a recap, Miles, for people who don't, who were not.
Kathy Griffin, Donald Trump famously said, grab them by the haha, grab them by the whoever. Kathy Griffin with this photographer who I can't remember his name, but the photographer and Kathy Griffin got a Trump mask, put ketchup on it, made it like it was bleeding, took the head and took a picture of Kathy Griffin holding a Trump mask with ketchup on it to look like a beheaded Trump head, which was with this news today seems to be a little prophetic, but dark humor, sorry. But that just was a firestorm of controversy. She got canceled. Anderson Cooper stopped being her friend. A lot of celebrities came out, called her disgusting and all this other stuff. And this was before, I guess, for a lot of people, Trump past this inappropriate bar, because I feel like she was actually just early by creating that kind of imagery. I think she was just early, but anywho, a lot of people had things to say about it, but she was effectively canceled and Trump went after her. Trump went after her. Trump investigated her. Trump she was a flight risk. She couldn't work. Trump went after her while he was a president. This is just unheard of for a president, a sitting president, to go after a private citizen like this, specifically over something that is so obviously art and commentary, specifically when you decide to be a public figure, a political public figure. This makes me scared for Taylor, because this tweet is what he can get away with now, but there's something inside of me that knows that if Trump were to become president, he would specifically go after Taylor Swift to make an example after her, because he's done it before. And that's what kind of scares me about it, is because we should be able, as artists and as public figures, be able to say what we feel and speak. And she didn't say anything wild. She didn't say anything controversial. Wasn't provocative. It was the most white bread, white liberal thing you can say, and she was still getting so much heat around it. So yes, that's why I'm scared as a Taylor Swift agnostic, but I'm still a humanist. I still love humans. So I'm actually just scared for her now, because I'm like, you just said an Instagram post, and now if he does become the man in power, he's definitely going to come after you.
On the one hand, I mean, he has said that, right, Miles? He said that if he is reelected, he is going to use every tool and weapon in his arsenal to punish his detractors and to go after people and whatnot, and to use the Justice Department. And so, when people tell you who they are, believe them. He's done it before. He will do it again. I saw something on the internet. I got to pay attention a little bit more, but it basically said, Trump has said he's going to do X, Y, Z, and Q, and you keep saying, and undecided voters keep saying, I need to know more about Kamala Harris. And so I think the real deal is we have to judge this man on what he says he's going to do and what he has already done. I'm also just sort of like amazed at how petty he is, like how easy it is to needle him on the littlest things, right? Like I hate Taylor Swift, like, bruh, come on. Or, we watched him go into a tailspin on a debate when Kamala Harris talked about the size of his rallies. Oh, my soul.
Mr. Obama. Walked him.
Right. I mean, it is, and to me, like, if I am that campaign, I read about this weekend about there's a group of 25-year-olds who are Kamala's like TikTok brigade. They are her social media team, and they just create meme after meme that goes viral with the youngs, and it is like they don't. It was talking about how, like, usually in campaigns, like, things go through 250 different approval processes and stuff. And they've given these young people the freedom to just go and create the moments. And Mr. Trump gives them so much to play with because he's such a 5-year-old. A 5-year-old is the exact right characterization. If I were them, I would just keep on with the size of his rallies and the size of whatever else and all of the things that, like, literally send his head into a tailspin, because then he can't concentrate on anything else, which I just think. And this is the dude that y'all want to give the nuclear codes to.
I will just say, and I know that, like, I know this goes without saying, but if any person of color, Kamala or insert here, ever did any of this, it would be, she's a child. She's immature. She's too emotional.
Not fit to be the president.
That and it's been interesting because I actually realized slowly that I went to Bowdoin with some people who are Trumpers. And because we're still Facebook friends, I looked up. I'm like, who am I? Is this my public page? I'm like, oh, this is I know these people. And to see people do backflips, like somebody I know from college put on Facebook, I'm annoyed that Kamala calls herself working, like says she grew up working class. Hold it.
She's a middle class. I was arguing with this person on who you were talking about. I'm saying she said middle class.
Okay. Well, he said working class, and she, and the guy's like, well, when your father's a professor and your mother, is that really working class? I was poor when I, and I'm like, critique notwithstanding, you have no smoke for Donald Trump, like nothing, like no. I'm like, this man, nobody. It is shocking the way that people do backflips to not name the way that race is, like the way that I've seen white people who support Trump not name the way that race is completely allowing this to happen is just, I know it is not shocking to us, but I have to say it out loud because when I see it, I'm like, if she ever did this, if she ever did, I hate Hulk Hogan. It would be endless news stories. It would be 24-hour coverage. Mm-hmm. Crazy.
It reminds me of, I believe, Chris Rock or Dave Chappelle, or I think both of them had jokes about this, is that how for as long as you have to be as exceptional as Vice President Harris and Barack Obama have to be in order to be president or in order to even be in there, there's really not actually racial equity. Part of there being racial equity is if and when we see a Black person able to be Black like this in the White House. That is racial equity, because even as you watch the debate, you're like, no matter how you feel about Vice President Harris, she's an intelligent, capable woman and an intelligent, capable Black woman. And the fact that she's not in the boxing ring with a peer, she's in a boxing ring with an intellectual 5-year-old who just has made a career out of being a orange failure. It's sad. It's disrespectful. It's like if you see Muhammad Ali and he's with some 12, 13-year-old big shot big mouther. You know what I mean? In the ring, and you're like, well, why is Muhammad Ali being disrespected by even matching this person up with this? You should be matched up with other excellence, even if it's ideologically on the far, on the right of her, at least be matched up with somebody who is worthy of her time. And I feel like that is a huge macrocosm of like what ends up happening in so many Black folks' lives, specifically capable, intelligent, exceptional Black women.
Now that you just brought up Muhammad Ali, this is a complete tangent, but I finally finished Who Killed Malcolm X on Netflix. Must see. Okay. I had no clue about Malcolm's life after he leaves the Nation of Islam. Like, I had never heard a speech. I hadn't heard him talk during those years. Like the whole controversy around who killed him, and Muhammad Ali he's in it for a brief period, but blew my mind. Shocking. Must see.
So like, good.
I don't want to give away the things that blew my mind truly, but yes.
So good. So good.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come.
Moving on to our news. My news is a continuation of a long conversation that we have been having about efforts to turn back DEI initiatives. We've talked about it a few times, but the Fearless Fund, which is an incubator and a supporter of women entrepreneurs of color, has been embroiled in a case with Edward Blum, and who is the person who is kind of the architect of the dismantling of affirmative action. And now he's bringing all of these cases in the private sector. We reported before that the Fearless Fund was under attack and that their program to fund Black women entrepreneurs was deemed unconstitutional and that they needed to dismantle the program, or that they needed to make it open to non-Black women in order to keep it going. And the Fearless Fund has decided to shut down its grant program for Black women to end this affirmative action lawsuit. And I think on its face, there is a lot of disappointment and feelings of loss because this resource is no longer there and because it seems like the conservatives have won. But I brought this to the pod because, and I don't have a lot to say, but I brought it to the pod because I think we're going to continue talking about this. And what was most interesting to me is that they decided to shutter this program and to not fight this in court, because in fact, what the conservatives want is for this to go to higher and higher and higher courts, including the, you know, clearly packed right-wing Supreme Court, to create precedent which would have an effect across the whole entire country. By shuttering the program, it's a legal strategy, actually, to make sure that this is contained just to the 11th Circuit, which is Florida and Alabama and Georgia, I think. Yes, Florida, Alabama, and Georgia. And it means that this particular decision is only binding in that circuit and is not binding across the country. So we live to fight another day. We figure out some other strategies, but we thwart the effort to make this national by going through the vehicle that they want us to go through, which is the courts, the federal courts, which, if you remember, Mr. Trump placed more federal judges than any other president in history. And so I thought it was interesting that instead of just going down the road that they have laid out for us, we are regaining some of our legal strategery, a Kaya Henderson word, to think differently about how we begin to win these battles. And so wondered what you all thought about that.
I thought it was great. You know, two things come to mind, and I thought about this a lot, Kaya, in preparing for this. I'm sure that you saw similarly that there were, as the university numbers are coming out around Black people and affirmative action, right?
Mm-hmm. And numbers are down 8% at Harvard or something like that for Black
numbers are down.
Students.
But I'm happy you brought up Harvard. Harvard is interesting because Harvard, while it might be down a little bit, it is still at 14%. Mm-hmm. And it is relatively high given the demographics of Black people going to college and da-da-da, did not. And it was interesting to see that because there are white people who are livid about Harvard's number because they wanted a bigger drop. Mm. And it has been interesting to see that, like, you know, there are ways to continue to make sure that it's demographically diverse, but there is this, I don't know another way to say it besides white supremacy, like white supremacy is using every strategy it can. And I got online when I saw the Harvard numbers, immediately I saw these white people saying that they are going to sue Harvard for violating the Supreme Court, that they are calling for suing Harvard because the fact that the numbers did not drop more means that Harvard must have cheated.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, y'all, this dirty, this dirty. The second thing I'll say, though, is I don't know where our legal team is, but I want there to be a lawsuit around why white people have money and da da da, like a reverse lawsuit around like what, why are white people the only people appointed to things, have like, that is a, it is true, it is by design, and I want a big group to put together a cogent legal argument and force that in the courts. Like, I want that to be like a, something that is fought out in front of a jury and like not something that we talk about only in academic circles or in living rooms, but that we like fight that out in the room because they are fighting us on this and it is brutal.
I am really, like, just to echo what you were saying, Kaya, I am really happy that we're not just following the trail that they set out in front of us. And I'm not going to pretend to 100% understand what the full legal strategy is. And I'm assuming that I shouldn't. That means that somebody's smarter and more legalized and fluent in legalese is in front of it. You know what I mean? That those are all Feral Rapture, Miles E. Johnson words. So that does bring me some relief that there is some strategy, because I think that so long and for decades, anytime that we're interacting with the legal system, we really hope that the legal system, the justice system, implements justice, and we know that that's not always going to happen. And it feels like there's somebody who was being not just hopeful, but also just realistic about the strategy that's needed, and made some quick calls. I am just, you know, I'm an emotional person. I am just sad. Mm-hmm. I am just sad at, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, that's a long time when you're talking about college, when you're talking about your career, when you're talking about life. And it's just the fact that we are just being distracted by white supremacist strategies that we have to gut and figure and strategize around. It just makes me sad because Black people don't need no wasted time. We don't need time to be wasted. Black women don't need time to be wasted. And I think that is just an emotion I want to speak towards. It's just the sadness that, again, very capable Black women, very capable people are wasting their time on things that, if I'm being quite frank, it's all the curse words. just geniuses wasting their time fighting with dummies.
So it makes me sad. I have some sadness generally, but I am actually energized by this.
Let me know.
Yeah, I am energized by this because one, necessity is the mother of invention. And I think for a long time, like, we just didn't think that we could ever get back to this place, right? And in a heartbeat, we have gotten back to this place. And I think that we now have figured out, oh, sugar, we actually have to redouble our efforts. We have to think in new and creative ways to get the things that we know are going to support our community. And I think that all of these things that people mean for bad are going to ultimately end up for our good. So for me, DeRay, the Harvard stuff is so interesting because here's what I think is going to happen if we play out this affirmative action stuff over the long haul. Like, let me couple this with the fact that applications to HBCUs are surging, like 60% increases in application numbers, right? And a lot of these kids are the kids who would go to Harvard. I have a friend whose kid, his top choice was Yale. He was going to Yale. It's the only place he ever wanted to go. He grew up here in Washington, D.C., spent a summer at Howard and was like, he's biracial. And he spent a summer at Howard. He was like, oh my God, like, these are my people. I need to go here. She called me and was like, oh my God, I think he's going to choose Howard. And I was like, that's great. It's going to be fantastic for him. He can go to graduate school or whatever at Yale, blah, blah, blah. I think this is going to be formative. I think this is going to be amazing. He is at Howard. He is killing it. He's having a great time. He feels validated, supported, all kinds of stuff. And I think that I think what we will begin to see is a lot of top Black talent will choose to not be in a place that doesn't want them, will choose HBCUs. And what will ultimately end up happening is, you know, those places are going to have to come and look. First of all of the data about diversity shows that your college or university is stronger, gets better outcomes. Your companies are stronger, get better outcomes when you have diverse staff. And people know that the bottom line is the bottom line. And so at some point, it's fine now. But at some point, after too much Black talent leaves these Ivy League schools and these other places that don't want us affirmatively, we are going to build powerhouse institutions. They already are powerhouse institutions, but they are going to have to come to us to beg for talent. And I think that, you know, if I'm a student of history and I look at the Reconstruction era where Black people had their own stores, banks, insurance companies, schools, whatever, we were fine on our own. I'm not advocating for segregation. I'm not a separationist or whatever. But I am trying to remind us that we have enough talent, assets, resources in our own community that the ice is not colder on that side of the world. In fact, we are brilliant and amazing. And if people don't want us, we don't have to run to that. We can create our own things and attract people. We set the tone for everything, fashion, music, drama. God, don't get me started. Anyway, I say all of that to say that I think that that this affirmative action stuff may play out in ways that Mr. Blum and his compadres never even thought about. And I'm interested to see what happens. And I'm excited that we are not sitting on our laurels, that we are finding new ways to do the things that we know need to get done.
Okay, you turned my light on. That's why it's good to have a friend, because when you can't turn your own light on, you got a friend to turn that switch on.
Because I'm a believer,
because I do think that I would not call myself a separate. I don't know.
You don't have to answer right now. I don't want to say
because I might think about it and say, like, you know what, I might believe in a little bit of separation. if I'm being quite honest. But what I do think is that since the 80s, a lot of Black people who can be educated, who are middle class, upper middle class, really did not. In big numbers, I don't want to say something that's too general, but in big numbers, a lot of Black people did not value how important it is for us to have our own coalitions, to have our own institutions. And I think when we look at things, I think this really shows in when we think about medical issues in hospitals and stuff. I'm like, no, we need black hospitals. Mm-hmm. We don't. We need black doctors at black hospitals doing black things on black bodies. And we see the evidence, and we see the numbers and the data around that not happening. And I think that we undervalue that post integration. And I think that this is a opening to recorrect those things. So.
Can I say one more thing on this? I just want to hold up a book called The Devil You Know by Charles Blow. My book club read it a couple years ago, and then I happened to see Mr. Blow last week at the Edlock convening talking about it. And what is fascinating about it is he makes the case that that the Great Migration was actually terrible for Black people, right? That we gave up land resources, we gave up political power in the South, we gave up a bunch of familial and societal clout and whatnot, and moved all north to live in tenements and let the people put us in factories and get us poor. And he basically advocates for a reverse migration. And we've already seen a lot of Black people moving to the South. But he makes the case that if Black people, if not even all of us, if a critical mass of us who lived in the North moved to 8 states in the South, that we would actually have the political power to like determine every single election in the United States. And that kind of strategery is what I'm interested in, right? I had no plans on, and you know, there are certain states that don't really count, but there are certain states that count more than others. And if we concentrated ourselves in those places, the level of political power we would have would be so outsized that we would be determinative of every major national election. And so that is the kind of interesting strategic thinking that is turning on my light, Miles.
Charles Blow, The Devil
Yes.
You Know.
The Devil You Know.
That's, that's fascinating. I didn't necessarily think about the political aspect, but that was so much of the motivation of me leaving New York City was I need to find a black community that feels abandoned. And I really felt big on channeling my resources and my time and planting it and helping a community that needs it, a community that feels abandoned, a community that within a generation or in a few decades or in a couple of decades rather, might not be there and just be totally forgotten. That doesn't just happen in Black communities. If you think about Appalachian, how like ghost towns there too. So that was so much my motivation. Did not think about it specifically only when it comes to the South. But that's so interesting because my mind has been on that track too. So thank you for that.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
My news is about the DC Police Department. As you all know, Kai used to be the superintendent of DC Public Schools.
I just have
what
to
that
give
to
her
do
a
with
shout
the
out. Just gotta give her a shout out. Just to, you know, we love Kai.
Thank you. Receiving it all.
Whenever Kai returns to public life, I'll be there and bells and whistles. And but the auditor's office in DC did a report on the staffing levels of the DC Police Department. DC, at its heyday of the police department, had close to 4,000 patrol officers. That's a lot of people, given that DC is not a huge geographic location. And DC, remember, has a lot of
700,000 people, not even a million.
And remember that DC has a lot of police departments already there who have police power in DC. So you get the Metro Police Department, which is the DC Police Department, but you got Secret Service, you got the Parks Police, you got the Capitol Police. It's
the
no
FBI,
shortage of
all of them get to play here.
And they all have power to arrest, do whatever. Like they might not all do traffic stops, but they all can arrest you if they want to. They can do that in DC because it's DC. And shout out to the auditor. I'm bringing it up because this auditor report is a model. It is one of one.
give Kathy is the auditor's name, give her an award. I don't know Kathy, but she did her big one on this. I don't, you know, some people might not like it, but she did this one. Now, here's the thing about the police. If there's anything that I've learned in a decade, and I would not have said this 10 years ago, is that your political leaders are afraid of the police. They actually don't always agree with them. Behind closed doors, they get it, but they are definitely afraid of disagreeing on the record. The city council people won't do it. The administrators of other departments won't do it. And the mayors won't do it. So DC has been saying they need 4,000 officers, blah, 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 carjackings, blah, blah, blah. And how do they get to 4,000? Literally, their rationale is it used to be 4,000. Like, that's all it's been. There's no math, no nothing, no like by quadrant of the city. Da, da, da. And what I love is that the auditor was like, at best, you probably need 65 more detectives because you have a lot of patrol people and y'all aren't closing cases. And, you know, the clearance rate in DC is really bad. So for non-fatal shootings, it's less than 25%. That means that if you get shot at, there's less than a quarter chance that the police are even going to arrest anybody, let alone the person gets convicted. But all of their numbers in DC are really bad. So they're like, you probably need 65 more detectives. But then they're like, you're actually adequately staffed to do everything else. And I love it because, and they highlight things like this. Here's a sentence from the report. As of July 2023, a third of all officers assigned to police service areas were allocated to the midnight shift, yet only a quarter of the calls for service occurred during the midnight shift. What you find in police departments is the wildest mismanagement you've ever seen. School systems, whether you like school systems or not, school systems don't get away with this sort of stuff. Schools have to be, you know, could you imagine if we only staff schools when the kids weren't there? Everybody would be like, that doesn't make sense. But the police do things that make no sense. And everybody just says, okay, up until this report. And of course, the police response is like, you know, this is wild. And one of the rationales for the auditor saying they need more detectives is that more than double the average overtime and comp time hours per employee are with detectives. Like, they are just working a ton. Now, the police chief is saying that there's a lot of overtime with the patrol officers. And because there's so much overtime with them, she's using that as a case to say, we need more patrol officers. The auditor's like, no, you just got them doing all types of random stuff. You need to take these uniformed officers off of administrative roles and put them back on a beat. You need to take people off the midnight shift when nobody's calling the police and put them somewhere else. You actually have good staff or the right number of staff. You actually have no strategy to maximize the resources. And mind you, the police are making a ton of money. So I love this report because, you know, we always have to deal with the staffing thing as the boogeyman in the room. That every police department needs more people. And nobody's ever done an analysis of like what is happening with the people. And I love it. Shout out to the DC auditor's office. The mayor's pissed about it. The police chief's mad about it. We'll see what the council says, but it is a model of a report.
Do you think, I have a question. Do you think that you know, or what's the motivation behind wanting more staff for the police?
Yeah, I think that, I think that the city people, almost all cities I've worked in, they have no clue what to do about crime. But people feel comforted when you say you hired more police officers. And that is like more emotional than strategic. It's the idea that I can go into a community and say that I hired 500 more officers and people are like, you did something for me. Whether crime changes or not, that makes people feel better. And it masks the inefficiencies and bad leadership. Because if you just have, you know, 2,000 more people, you don't really have to put them in shifts that make sense because it's just so many people that it sort of masks the fact that there is really poor leadership.
What's interesting to me being a person, like just a regular citizen of DC, is this narrative about us needing more police is super salient, right? Like on every bus ad and, you know, in your Uber on the little screen, there are advertisements for the Metropolitan Police Department. The starting salary is $66,000. After 5 years of service, you make $88,000. And if you join MPD right now, you get a $25,000 hiring bonus and $6,000 in rental assistance. And so there is a frenzy, like people are coming here to apply because the benefits are so good. Young people are joining the police force because, I mean, ain't nobody else giving you a $25,000 hiring bonus and $6,000 in rental assistance in a city that has, you know, an affordable housing crisis. And I think, I do think about it in terms of schools and school districts, right? Like one of the things in the report said that, you know, this, our police department has 10 chiefs and other jurisdictions that are similarly sized have 6 chiefs, and the chiefs all make, you know, a few $100,000 and that kind of a thing. Those are the kinds of comparisons that we make for school districts all the time. How many teachers do similarly sized districts have? What is the organizational structure? And this is the first time that I've ever seen that about a police department, and specifically my own police department. I think it's going to be interesting to see what people do about this, because I think you're right, DeRay. There is the sort of narrative. There are like so many competing narratives right now. On the one hand, you know, we have the fear mongering. Every kid is a carjacker, and crime is at an all time high. The police department is saying crime is at an all time low, but we still need more police officers. Like, what is the criminal justice narrative in DC? And what do we do about it? I think this is the first time that I've ever seen data put against what we should do strategically. And I do think that the mayor and the council have an opportunity to be data driven and data informed and make some very different decisions than the ones that we've been making on these narratives that have been unsupported, frankly.
I will say one thing, too, is that it's interesting that the one thing that the department pushes back on pretty intensely after the report came out is that they refuse to track the time of the officers. So the report says in a very report way that the MPD needs to, quote, urgently needs to gather more comprehensive data. And it goes on about how officers currently spend their time and then design a staffing model based on that, which is basic. The department is like, no. So we don't know. Yeah, they're just like, we don't need to do that. And you're like, you know, if anything, citizens assume this is happening. They're like, oh, you know, we know. Let me tell you, across the country, we have no clue what officers are doing. We don't know. We only know because the cars have GPS trackers on them. So we know, can tell if we have to where they are. But when you see those pictures of the people in the NYPD just on their phone playing video games, the unions fight so hard and the police chiefs defend this idea that they know best. And you asking what the police are doing with their time is crazy. And again, I came from a school system, so did Kaya. If I, you know, in the union things, we're negotiating the 12 minutes you got for lunch. We're negotiating the 4 minutes afterwards, you know, that you got to be in the classroom for after school programs. We have to account for the workday for people in schools. We do, you know? The police, it's just like, show up. That is wild to me.
I don't know if I'm saying the quiet part out loud, or if I should have a tinfoil hat on. But also, conservatives, Republicans overrepresent in a lot of police forces. And to me, it also would seem as though these requests for more staff is a way to irrigate people who are conservative at best, white supremacists at worst, into the police force. And to me, that feels very obvious.
I would say that might be the case in a lot of other places. But our police force is overwhelmingly Black, I'm pretty sure. We have a Black chief, and I think, DeRay, you can figure this out quicker than I can, but I think we are an overwhelmingly Black police force.
Yeah, you're talking about as DC? As far as
yes,
DC?
Yes.
So I guess I'm going back to Georgia, I'm going back to the South, I'm going back to where I'm at now, and I'm thinking in general, because I see the same type of kind of like propaganda here where I'm at now and when I was in Georgia. So that was really to be more applied to the Midwest and the South and literally DC. But that's my commentary too. So it's just that certain people are, or certain police forces are using that staffing narrative in order to make police, in my opinion, use policing as an irrigation system to get white supremacists inside of the police force. And I know that may not be happening in DC, but I think that is happening. And I think that this auditor doing what they were doing sets a precedent so we can actually put closer eyes on what's actually happening in other police systems. I think this sets like precedents to like, how can we examine why does the police system look like this in Ohio or in the Midwest or in Georgia or in Mississippi? And what is the police force being used to? I'm glad that this is happening in DC because I think that this can be applied to a lot of different places. Because I think the police are using their power in a lot of different places to do things that are violent. So I'm glad that that somebody's holding this police force accountable.
I will say a cursory search means, maybe it's just me, but it's really hard to find the the demographic information about DC's police department. The last number that I see was for 1970.
I didn't want to get into a too deep of a rabbit hole with what I was talking about, but you know, the Boys in the Hood scene where the black police officer was the one who was terrorizing the black man. I want to say racial identity does not mean that the police force is not a conservative force or is not a white supremacist force. So I didn't want to get into like a huge debate about that. But I was like, just because there's Negroes there does not mean white supremacy is not afoot.
True. I did find some numbers from 2013, which says black officers are 57%, Hispanic officers 7%, Asian 3%, and white 33%. So
yeah, so thinking about how those people vote, what their ideas are about other black people, some of the hostile ideas about black people come from
black people. Mm-hmm. We could say we gotta name all the things. Thank you, Miles. Thank you.
You saw me. I was over here like, oh, this is hot lava.
Yes. We're not scared. We all right.
Okay. So speaking of not really being scared. Not scared. Speaking of not being scared. Katy Perry. So I wanted to bring this up when it comes to Katy Perry, because I'm kind of a Katy Perry agnostic. I love Teenage Dream. She was a big part of the music scene when I was younger, but I have nothing for or against her as a human being. But I did want to bring this situation up because I think it does highlight a bigger problem when it comes to journalism and media, because I think that we also see J.D. Vance and Trump using the same types of tools in media navigation systems as Katy is. So if you don't know about the news, Katy Perry has spoken about her decision to collaborate on her new album with Dr. Luke after her music producer was accused of sexual assault by Kesha. Perry was asked about the decision on Alex Cooper's Call Her Daddy podcast and acknowledged that it had been a talking point ahead of 143's release later this month. She was asked about Dr. Luke after spending much of the podcast discussing how she overcome past relationships with narcissistic men who couldn't handle me in the boss mode. Without addressing the allegations or mentioning him by name, she said, "I understand that it started a lot of conversations and he was one of the many collaborators that I collaborated with. But the reality is, it comes from me. The truth is, I wrote these songs from my experience of my whole life going through this metamorphosis, and he was one of the people to help facilitate all of that." She added, "I'm speaking from my own experience. When I speak about Woman's World, I speak about feeling so empowered now as a mother, as a woman. I created all this with several different collaborators, people that I've collaborated with from the past, from Teenage Dream era, all of that." So the news is not that Katy Perry said that, because she was doing her job right. She did not answer the question. She did not even say Dr. Luke's name. She skirted around. She did her job right. The person, Alex, who's the host of the Call Her Daddy, is where I actually have the issue with. Because BU1 Barbara Walters would have had a follow-up question for that. And it's a weird time in media where somebody can sit down, make a feminist pop song, and then not have to be asked truly investigative feminist questions about how do you make a song about woman empowerment and collaborate musically with somebody who has disempowered, to put it lightly, another woman. And I think that that is a fair question to ask Katy Perry. I think that's a fair question to ask Doja Cat and anybody who still collaborates with Dr. Luke and has a feminist tint to their pop brand in order to recreate their stardom. I think that's a fair question. And my concern is that those fair questions aren't being asked because there's nobody sitting in the question asker seat. I don't want to call it the journalist seat, but nobody's sitting in the question asker seat asking those follow-up questions. And you might say, well, Miles. And I will say, yes. And you'd be like, well, it's Katy Perry. Who cares? Trump's doing the same thing. The reason why Trump is going to these red pill podcasts, the reason why J.D. Vance is going and bouncing around these red pill podcasts is because he knows he's not going to be asked these hard questions. He knows that he's not going to be challenged. And that is something that is pervasive throughout culture. And I think there's a way, when we look at the Whitney Houston interview that was with Diane Sawyer, when we look at Michael Jackson's interviews, when we look at Britney Spears' interviews, I think there's a way that we can see how journalists have conducted interviews in the past that might feel exploitative, might feel harsh, might feel toxic in this new soft speak culture that we're all in, without throwing, you know, all of our journalistic and just curious muscles. It doesn't even have to be with being a journalist. We should just have curious muscles around what's going on in the psychology of an artist who is creating feminist pop propaganda and is with somebody who was accused of sexual assault multiple times. We like that. To me, that feels like a fair question, and it scares me that we're gonna be in an era where pop artists, celebrities are able to construct whole narratives and just be deeply contradictory with no curiosity around their mindset, their morals, their politics. That scares me. And I feel like Katy Perry is the first person, or excuse me, the person of this week who's been utilizing this and who's been using this parasocial, I'm just sitting down with another girl talking, and that's my engagement with the public in order to me escape accountability, escape thoughtful questions, to escape having to dig a little deeper and having to be looked at a little bit deeper for your actions. Again, this is not to cancel or terrorize in any way Katy Perry, but a really good question is, Dr. Luke, I believe survivors, Dr. Rook sexually assaulted somebody. You make pop feminist songs. Sexual assault is not a pop feminist thing to do. How do you reconcile in your spirit working with somebody who has harmed another woman as you're saying things about women empowerment? Is that a hard question? Sure. Is that a question that I think somebody who is getting wealth and fame from feminist ideals and aesthetics? I think that's a fair question. I know that has to be a fair question. And again, Francis Coppola is in the news right now because he was doing wild things on set. I think a lot of, I've been in a Roman Polanski rabbit hole, watching Chinatown, Rosemary's Baby, and stuff like that. Like, I just been in a rabbit hole when it comes to him, but also in a rabbit hole of watching how, in the era where he was accused of having sexual relations with a 13-year-old, how that was treated. How that was treated by the media, how that was treated by his peers. And I kind of see us recreating certain bubbles. Again, I don't want to totally do a straight line between Roman Polanski and Katy Perry, of course, but I do want us to investigate how we're still recreating certain bubbles to make sure that people who are powerful and famous remain powerful and famous no matter what. And I think that Katy Perry is assisting that bubble being around Dr. Luke. And I think that she and herself is creating this bubble around her so she doesn't have to be questioned about what's going on. You know, even last thing that I'll say, this is on the film track. Even when I was watching Mia Farrow had so horrendous things to say about Woody Allen. But she's been on record saying glowing things about Roman Polanski in her time at Rosemary's Baby. So it's an interesting thing to see somebody who understands assault in this, and understands perversion in this dynamic, but still does not apply that same type of earnest critique in another dynamic. That just seems weird to me. I'm always going to call it out. I'm always going to push people to want more for the people who are, you know, just going up the class rank because of our support. I think that we're allowed to ask some harder questions than what Call Her Daddy offered. What do you think, Auntie Kaya?
So I have a couple of thoughts. First of all, I think that your connection to that, that your assertion about this just being a media time of a lack of curiosity and us just letting narratives roll is really important. It is what Trump and J.D. Vance are doing, as referenced by J.D. Vance's recent comments on CNN, where he said, if I have to make up stories to get the American people to realize what's going on or whatever, I will. So I think the media should have been like, how did we let this fly? But like, they're not. This is just where we are in that. The media, which used to be a helpful tool of critical thinking for the American public, just is not anymore. The fact that we have wildly partisan networks and that kind of thing means that, you know, you get to let your narrative roll largely unchallenged because the people who are listening are the people who want to listen and not your critics. And that is why people go on certain podcasts and not other podcasts and whatnot. And I think also, you know, the whole bottom line thing, right? Like, people are in this for the money, and somewhere in your piece, it said that Katy's most lucrative, her best albums have been with Dr. Luke. And so she is trying to get her best album money. And I think that, you know, you talked earlier about the seduction of Hollywood and the compromises that you have to make to be in celebrity culture. And I think it is, you are absolutely right, it is a valid question to ask Katy Perry. And, comma, it made me think a lot about the Diddy situation. And how many people knew what was happening, how many women knew what was happening. There was just a new set of accusations that came out about how, you know, Diddy beat Cassie in front of a bunch of celebrities and nobody said anything or did anything. And he put her out and then they kept on having dinner. There is an amazing piece by Danielle Smith, I think it was in the New York Times, about how she knew what was happening with Diddy. She experienced some of the abuse and trauma that Diddy was laying out to folks all over the industry, and how for 27 years she didn't say anything about it. You know, she accuses him of attempting to kill her. And then having to stand with him at parties and take pictures and things, of knowing about a lot of the accusations. And for her, there is a, like, on the one hand, music is her thing. It's the thing that made her famous and fulfilled her childhood passions and whatnot. And the industry was corrupt and misogynistic and misogynoir and all of these things. And how she, it's not until now that she stepped back and is able to process all of this, that she is able to confront her complicity in it. Even at the same time being a victim and, you know, whatever, like just trying to survive and thrive. And I mean, you have so many examples of what happens to women when they buck the system. I mean, I'm not a Kesha fan. I'm not a, like, whatever, but I ain't heard Kesha's name since the whole Dr. Luke stuff, right? People, when they, you know, bring these issues up, get blackballed and blacklisted, and it affects their careers and those kinds of things. And so I think in the same way that we were interrogating James Earl Jones's, you know, stance, there is some of that going on here. The trade-offs that you have to make in order to be in the Hollywood machine is what this makes me think about.
You know, that's a good point. I think when it comes to Danielle's perspective, I think sometimes time helps me. You know, when I think about, oh, it was a different era, even though I was but a little chicken in the 90s. I do, in 2000s, I remember the media I was consuming, from rap music to Comic View. I remember the era. I don't understand it in 2024. Even when I saw Usher, and I Barbara Walters is just on my mind when I see things like this. So even when I saw Usher on The View, I was like, oh, wow, this is a commercial for Usher, which is great. But Usher also is very close to Diddy, has said nothing, and then also had photos come out with him with Russell Simmons in Bali recently, within the last year, and was asked nothing. No, just, oh my God, Usher, you're so sexy, you're so great, everybody go to your new residency in Paris. That's an interesting moment in media. That tip for me, that just feels really interesting, and it feels like a buck against that Me Too, maybe that resentment for what the Me Too movement did. That's maybe what I'm seeing, or a lot of publicists really making sure that they're...
Yeah, that is what it is. You know that they said on The View, these topics are off limits. And if you want Usher, who is one of the hottest stars right now, to be on your thing, this is what you can ask. And well, again, it's a trade-off.
They can be more brave and say, don't come. Don't come then. If we can't ask you questions, if you're going to do these actions... And we can't ask you questions about these actions, then don't come. And I wish that journalists were a little bit braver.
I do think it is interesting. I think about things like The Shade Room, Hollywood Unlocked, da da da. I talked to some of my white friends. They literally are like, we don't even know. They don't know, right? Whereas, you know, we remember Krishan, Blueface, whether you liked them or not, they were... You could not escape them on the black side of the internet for a period of time. Miss Netta, Charles, like, there are all these, just pop culture, forget even like hard news or whatever. There are these moments that happen on the internet in media publications, and I consider like The Shade Room, da da da, one of those. And then you get the Joe Rogans, you get Barry Weiss, you get Jordan Peterson, you get Adam Tate. You get that ecosystem, which is like, these are, you know, extremes in some way. And then you get call her daddy, call you daddy, whatever that podcast is called. You get a whole host of the podcasters. Mm-hmm. And it is interesting how the media landscape, that mainstream media just ignores them. Like, they aren't, you know, when's the last time you saw a CNN reporter on a Shade Room post? But there are a lot of people for whom that is their main way of consuming news. It just is true. Well, you ain't got to like it. It's just true. And I don't know when it will come to a head, when there's a collective conversation about standards or journalism or whatever, but it is interesting. You know, I don't know if you remember when Hollywood Unlocked reported that the queen had died. She didn't. That was a thing. Mm-hmm. You know, most recently, TMZ reported that Beyonce was going to be at the DNC. That did not happen, right? And these are small things. I mean, I was at the DNC, and people are telling me, like, people in the know are like, oh yeah, she coming, because I saw it on, and it's like, TMZ said that.
she's not coming, you know what I mean?
But I do, it is an interesting, and you have no incentive as a, you have no incentive as a artist. Wow. Like if you can reach a gazillion people with Kai Cenat sitting in his living room, who's live streaming, why do CNN? I can get 5 million people in 20 minutes. Why do CNN? Do you know what I mean? Like that makes sense to me, which is an interesting challenge to be in.
From the legal news coming out of Trump's countless trials to the latest headlines you see on your feed, Crooked's What a Day podcast is the place to get your daily news. The show has a new lead host, former Vox senior politics reporter and New York Times opinion contributor, Jane Costin. What a Day still offers the same quick listen, but now with even more curated headlines, in-depth reporting, and analysis about the stories that shape how you live, work, and play. Tune in Monday to Saturday to get the top news and stories that matter most, all in just 20 minutes. Search for What a Day on your favorite podcast app or YouTube, and don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Bossy and the People this week. Don't forget to follow us at Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Bossy and the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we'll see you next week. Bossy and the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by AJ Moultrie and mixed by Vasilis Poutopoulos. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Kai Henderson, DR Ballinger, and Miles E. Johnson.
Save big on everything for your next project now at Menards. Breathe easier with Best Air Allergen Air Filters. They trap larger airborne contaminants to keep allergens out of your home, and they last up to 90 days. Save big on all Best Air products at Menards and refresh your home today. View our entire selection of air filtration products on Menards.com. Plus, check out our weekly flyer and find great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.